Thanks, Julian. What I'm going to describe here today is some recent progress that we have in studying AGN outflows. In order to do that, I will tell you a little bit briefly introduction to AGN outflows, and then my common theme here on the observational side would show how the high-resolution spectroscopy, both in the optical UV and the X-ray band, is really revolutionizing the studies of this field. And without further ado, let me start by showing you the classical quasar outflows. These were discovered in the late 60s. These are the broad absorption line quasars. What you see here next to the emission line, the broad emission line carbon 4, you see a very broad trough. The Doppler width is 10,000 km a second, and it's blue shifted with respect to the systemic redshift of the emission line. Therefore, we know that this kind of phenomena comes from an outflow that's coming from the center of the quasar. And we have these velocities, which are far, the width here is 100 times larger than anything we're used to in absorption line from the ISM or IGM. You can see the same thing here in silicon 4 and in nitrogen 5 and oxygen 6. And in the old days, up until about 10 years ago, that was mainly the line that people had to work with. And they had to work with really, in our standard, very lousy spectroscopy resolution. People had about 300 kilometers a second resolution, did not allow to do much detailed models, did not allow to do too much, to get too much physics out of that. One of the pioneers of these days is Dave Turnchuk, that I think should be with us here. Ian Wyman have done a lot of work on that in the 80s and early 90s. I want to show that the outflow phenomena is go over all luminosity scales. This is a famous Seifert NGC 4151. You see the same thing, but the lines are much narrower. We know that the Seiferts are about two orders of magnitude or less luminous than the big quasars, and indeed the terminal velocity of the outflows is normally up to 1,000 kilometers a second. Actually, the absorption in the 4151 was discovered in the 30s, but it took a while until it was appreciated that it blue shifted and its outflows and stuff like that. Over the last 3 years, the most impressive breakthrough is the X-ray spectroscopy, which we saw some 2 days ago. And you can see in NGC 5548, similar absorption trough, but look at the wavelength. Okay, we're talking about 10, 20, 30 angstroms. Most of the ions that you see here are helium-like and hydrogen-like ions of all the metals, oxygen, carbon, and et cetera. And as I will say several times during this talk, trying to actually verify what is the connection between these absorption troughs and the absorption you see in the UV and optical is absolutely crucial right now. So a little bit of a geometrical plausible view, just to give you a frame of mind. Supermassive black hole. Sometimes we have the relativistic jet we learned a lot about yesterday. We have the accretion disk. We think the winds that I'm talking about are disk winds. They arise from the disk and they come in some angle. So if the observer is here at a low angle above the disk, our line of sight crosses the outflows and we see outflows in this object. If we sit here, we don't see that. And we interpret the observational evidence that 50% of all Seiferts show outflows to say that the outflow in that case cover 50% of the solid angle. In quasars, only 10% of quasars show broad absorption lines, so probably the angle substandard is a little bit smaller. What is our wish list? And some of these questions here, I try to put as, you know, a realistic steps for the next 3 years, so if we'll come here again in 3 years' time, we can actually have real progress done. So the first important question that we have to work on is, and I said, what is the relationship between the UV and X-ray warm absorbers? Essentially, is it the same gas? Are we looking at the both phenomena are showing the same dynamical component of the outflow? Once we'll get a good handle on that, we have a much better chance to solve for the ionization equilibrium and abundances in the outflow, which is crucial to get the physical conditions. abundance in studies with these outflows is an extremely useful tool, at least in principle, because unlike studying emission lines of quasars, we don't integrate over our huge volume of physical conditions that turn out to be a point source. We actually look through a pencil beam all the way down to the central monster, and we are much less confused by different physical conditions on our line of sight. We really would like to know where is the outflow and what accelerates it, and Jim Chang is going to give us a full talk about acceleration, I think, acceleration models. And all these things are hopefully will give us the holy grail of our field. I don't think, and most people working in this field do not think, that the outflow can tell us much about the central source. This is, I don't think this is a good scientific, goal. However, the outflows are probably very important in the evolution of both the AGN and the host galaxy, and we would really like to get a handle of that. We heard 2 days ago during the discussion, there was a lot of comments about that, and yesterday in Tiziana's talk about how much outflow can change a lot of things in the accretion rate into the central black hole. So we would really like to know that. And what I will show you is, unfortunately, almost all our objects are point source, so we don't see much. But we think the picture, if we will see stuff, it will be something like this. This is NGC 3079, and this is the work of Gerald Cecil. What you can see here is this huge super bubble in about a kiloparsec size, which is very probably connected to an AGN-like outflow, but on a much lower luminosity object. And yet, you have that dramatic effect on the entire environment. You have the material spewing out, basically, and interact with the material around it. And we are thinking that in the higher luminosity objects, the phenomena will be the same, only more powerful, and can be more influential on the evolution of the galaxy. So up to here, just a little bit background. What is the prospect of high-resolution spectroscopy? This is low-resolution spectroscopy of one specific quasar, and what you see here is a magnesium-2 in emission, and next to it you see magnesium-2 in absorption. A blow-up of that region with the leak data of a full hour shows you that you have this structure, and I want to concentrate on this little feature here. You see it has three substructure in it, and the question is, what happened when we take a big telescope like Keck with the high-resolution spectrograph? We put the we take data with 50 times the resolution, and when we do that, we get this. The black is what you had before, exactly. The red is the Keck high-res data. You can see the richness of phenomenology, how much more information we can get. And the main question is, okay, we have all this terrific amount of information now. Can it really tell us about the physics and what's happening in the object? I will try to convince you that we can. Well, now we have to go back to the basics, the very, very basics. How are we going to get physical information out of absorption lines? Well, most of us learned in the first year of grad school how you do that. Here is an absorption line in blue. Then you have several simple methods. Of course, the first one is the equivalent width. We just take the equivalent width of a line and we get the column density through it. A slightly better way of doing it when you have good resolution data, when you fully resolve the feature, is what is called the apparent optical depth. You say the resolution density is e to the minus tau, then you know tau at each position, and the column density of the absorber will be given by this expression. And this gives you the observable quantity that you can extract from the trough, the absorber column density of each feature like that. A hybrid of that is Gaussian modeling. People, if the data is not as good, is not that good, you can just say that the optical depth is in the form of a Gaussian, and you will fit a Gaussian to each of these features. Gaussian are extremely flexible function to work with. We have three parameters that can move it right and left, up and down, and make it wider and narrower. One of the principal points in my talk will try to convince you that we have to get away from Gaussian modeling of these outflow. It simply does not work. We have Gaussians are very good physical presentation for thermal gas. When we get away from thermal gas, when we have dynamics involved, this is a very bad idea to use Gaussians. I'll try to convince you in that. High resolution spectroscopy was also done in the UV recently, both with HST and FUSE. The UV band dramatically improved our capabilities because we can see all the major resonance lines in the UV on close-by objects. Up until then, we could only work on high redshift quasar, where the lines were redshifted to our band, the optical band. This is Marquand 509. This is the 06 lines. You can see here that's work by Jerry Criss. And again, this is resolution of 20,000. The Keck resolution I showed you was about 50,000. And it opens a whole new window. Now, a few other people that have worked in this field using the HST spectroscopy are Mike Crenshaw and Steve Kramer. A lot of pioneering work was done over the last 4 or 5 years in that. Back to the basics. Here is a simple case in point, NGC 985. NGC 985 has this outflow in, as it's seen in Lyman alpha. And what I did here, I did a simple Gaussian modeling. And what I mean is I get the unabsorbed emission model. I convolve it with Gaussian for each of the feature that we see here. And as you can see, I get a quite good fit. I fit here 95% or more of the absorption is accounted for, with very small discrepancies. And everyone will say that the Gaussian model is a wonderful fit for the data. I will be able to extract the column densities now. There's no problem because I know the full width half maximum of the Gaussian and I know the normalization. And then I want to do some physics. So I have the neutral hydrogen column density of each of these features. And the question is, how do I proceed? Well, I need at least one more. So I do the same thing for nitrogen 5. Just shown briefly. It's the same exact thing. Interesting point, nitrogen 5 is a doublet, so we see the same absorption in the blue component and the red component, and you can see that it repeats itself. And we do the same thing, and we can get the column densities. So let's concentrate on this guy, which is the deepest of all absorption trap, component 4. We have the column density in neutral hydrogen. We have the column density in nitrogen 5. How are we going to get the physics? Well, we go to the gurus of the photoionization models, because we all think that the ionization equilibrium in this gas is dominated by the radiation field. So we use Claudy. We'd say, go to the guru and say, we have this column density and that column density. Find me a solution for the two physical quantities that we can extract. One is the size of the cloud with column density in total hydrogen, basically. And the second thing will be the ionization parameter. And the way we do that is, this is the way I advocate of doing it, using phase space presentation. This is a grid of models here showing you. For component number 4, we had column density in hydrogen 10 to the 14. And then I asked a simple question, where on the parameter space can 10 to the 14 column density live? Well, if you have very low ionization parameter, you need a very thin cloud, only 10 to the 18 or so, because a lot of the hydrogen will still be neutral. If the ionization parameter is very high and a very tiny fraction of hydrogen is neutral, you need a very thick cloud. This is why the black line is like this. Nitrogen 5 is similar. We have 10 to the 14.2, and it looks parabolic like this because there are many more stages of ionization. Here you are dominated by low ionization ions like nitrogen 1, 2, and 3. Here you are dominated by nitrogen 6 and 7, and here you get the maximum. Now, in this kind of presentation will allow you to get either zero solution or two solution in the general case. And as luck has it, we had just one solution here, so we don't have to think too much. But I want to point out that Claudy will always give you a physical solution if you'll give it two column densities. Without failing, you'll get a solution. The question is the solution have any physical meaning, or is just, you know, application of, you know, you have two equations and two unknowns, you'll always get a solution. Now, in this case, we already have what I call a major important result. Because the hottest issue I told you about is the connection between the warm absorber and the UV absorber. And here you see that this component has a column density about 10 to the 19 and an ionization parameter log of about 0. our X-ray friends in the last 2 years tell us that the warm absorber tend to live here, around 10 to the 21, 10 to the 22, and with another parameter of about 1 on the log scale. So obviously, if the warm absorber lives here in the parameter space, and the UV is here, it is almost impossible to have them from the same phase of gas. And indeed, there are several papers that have noted that over the last year. I want to cast a doubt on this result. And the way to do that is to work with data of the FUSE satellite. This is FUSE data that show the Lyman beta trough of the same object. It's a little bit more ratty, but what I'm going to do now is just to put the Lyman alpha on top of the Lyman beta. The shift doesn't have any free parameters because you just scale by the ratio of the wavelength. And what you see here is a major calamity. The reason it's a major calamity is because if we did the Gaussian modeling, we basically assume specifically that everything is optically thin, that the depth of the Gaussian is the optical depth, then we would expect that the blue absorption would be much less deep than the red absorption. The reason is Lyman beta has an oscillator strength 1/5 of Lyman alpha. So you expect to get intrinsically 1/5 of the optical depth in Lyman beta than you get in Lyman alpha. And obviously you see here that these are identical, 1, 2, 3, but it's not always like that. These subtroughs are not identical, so you have to do a very careful work here. Well, when we go to Lyman gamma, we see that the degeneracy breaks and we can actually measure the column density in neutral hydrogen. We find that the real column density is 5 times more than we previously thought naively. And then the question is how important this will be for the ionization results. Well, this is what I showed you before. That was our old solution with 10 to the 14. This is our new solution with 5 times that. As you can see, the column density of the absorber went up by more than 2 orders of magnitude. The ionization parameter went by more than an order of magnitude. Almost as by magic, our UV absorber and X-ray absorber can be exactly the same gas. Just because we accounted for this interesting non-black saturation. What I mean by that, if Lyman beta and Lyman alpha have the same depth, yet they are not black, they must be saturated, but we see that there are lots of photons on the bottom of the troughs. So we have a non-black saturation. When we accounted for that, we find that we can have the gas of the UV absorber and the X-ray absorber being the same thing. So now we have to try and understand a little bit this interesting phenomenon of non-black saturation. What I show here is a doublet line like carbon 4, nitrogen 5. The nice thing about the doublet line is that the ratio of optical depth is exactly 1 to 2 because of the oscillator strength. That is simple atomic physics. And the residual intensity of the blue line should be e to the minus 2 tau if the residual intensity of the red line is e to the minus tau. I gave the cartoon here that they are exactly the same. And what can cause that? Well, people have known of that for many decades. What can cause that is a phenomenon of partial covering of the source. What we did in the modeling begin with, naively, we assumed that the absorber covers the entire emission source, uniformly, and therefore e to the minus tau will be the right presentation of the residual intensity. But if we only cover part of the source, the photons that are streaming here will never see any absorber, and this is exactly what we can have. What we, in the cartoon that I showed you, we have a situation like this when this is totally optically thick. We don't know anything about the optical depth. The only thing we can see from the previous diagram is the actual covering fraction. And indeed, the covering fraction will be, if we measure it from here, the covering fraction will be from C up to here, and you will not know anything about the optical depth because it will be consistent with being very, very large. If we have an intermediate situation, when the ratio is between 1 and 2, we have a series of very simple equations that we can solve for the covering fraction and the optical depth, and then we can say what must be the covering fraction in order to retrieve the 1 to 2 optical depth ratios here. So that is easy to do. This is where the entire field stopped up until now. That realization came on the last 3-4 years. We did a lot of work on that to convince people in quasars. It slowly percolated into the CFIRT community, but people stop here, and most people still have the same mental picture that we are talking about these big clouds sitting in front of the source and partially covering it, and therefore a DC covering fraction is totally fine. And that is a picture that most people still have. I would like to try and knock that picture down. What if, at least theoretically, what if we have two identical troughs that have a lot of structure like this, but they are still identical at each and every point, the residual intensity of the blue and the red is the same? The unescapable conclusion will be that everything you see here is just covering fraction, but it's covering fraction velocity dependent. What I mean is that the shape of the troughs here must be just the shape of their covering fraction, or in the language I had before, it will just say that what we see here is nothing but covering fraction dependent upon velocity. We lost any information about the optical depth. And the first thing I want to see is, what does the data actually tell us? Before I will come to a dynamical picture of how this works. What is happening in real data? Here is another example of the power of high-resolution spectroscopy. I'm going to concentrate on this little bit of silicon 4 doublet. See the red part and the blue part. In the old days, this would not let us do anything because it's not even resolved. With the new powerful instruments that we have, this little part of the spectrum blows up to be this. Okay? Now with this, we can start doing physics. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to ask what is the mechanism that gives the line here its shape. We have the red absorption part of the doublet and the blue, and you see the power of the spectrograph. Every little thing here is being repeated on both, and the question is, what, when we solve for the covering fraction and the optical depth, what do we get? Are we going to get a covering fraction that is just one, just a complete screen? Is it going to be DC, like let's say 0.9 will be what the number that will work for everything, or is it going to be all covering fraction velocity dependent? So to do that, I shift both to the same velocity scale, just blew up these two troughs. The red doublet data is here, the blue is here, and I already I bin the data by a factor of 10, so I won't have any problem with line spread function of the spectrograph. Now for the solution. I'm going for each and every resolution element to solve for the covering factor. And when I do that, and it's totally non-model dependent, what I get is that the covering fraction basically is totally hugging the blue component data, meaning the entire shape of the trough is nothing but covering fraction in this case. Okay? This is unequivocal evidence to what I showed you before theoretically is actually happening in Mother Nature. The shape of these troughs, when you have good enough data and when you have resolved doublets that can solve for it, have this feature that almost the entire shape of the trough is dependent by the velocity-dependent covering fraction, and very little comes from optical depth. Now, to show you how little comes from optical depth, we, of course, immediately also solve for the optical depth too. This is just what I showed you before. Here is the solution for the optical depth. This is the apparent optical depth you get from the trough, and this is the real optical depth. And you can see the interesting thing is where the apparent optical depth is lowest here, the real optical depth is actually highest. So the maximum optical depth of the outflow is here. It's not here and not here, it's here. And that is because, again, the main mechanism for the line formation is covering fraction dependent upon velocity and not optical depth. So that should convince you immediately that Gaussian modeling will never ever work, because you in principle cannot put these effects into Gaussian modeling. And you can, of course, can forget about working with equivalent width on one line or apparent optical depth also. When I've done that to quasars, my friend from the CFIRT community said, well, this is for quasars, but CFIRTs are different. They will have Gaussian clouds standing in front. So I had to do the entire thing yet again. And nicely enough, it was a little bit faster this time. And NGC 5548, this is what you get for the main absorption in carbon-4. covering fraction, again, hugging the blue component of the doublet. The entire shape of the line is nothing but covering fraction. The optical depth is, on the average, 4 times larger. Column density is 4 times larger. And I've shown you what a difference in a factor of 4 in column density can do. Our entire conclusion about the photoionization can be totally different because the photoionization equations are so nonlinear. Now I'll put my theorist hat on, and I'll try and show you how on the hell would Mother Nature give us things, would give us velocity-dependent covering fraction. Well, this is my favorite model, which I now know laboring, carrying from conference to conference and place to place for the last 3-4 years. What I'm using here are two very simple things, saying the outflow is non-radial because quasars or AGNs are non-radial objects. If we get a wind from the disk, it's not totally radial, so it will intersect our line of sight in some angle. And then, of course, it is close enough, it may be close enough to the source that the size of the continuum will really matter. If you add to that the very plausible assumption that we're looking at continuously accelerating outflow, this is the only thing I really need to explain this magical phenomenon of covering fraction, which is velocity dependent. Because what you see here is, as the outflow accelerates here, in this velocity you're not going to see anything because it did not get into our line of sight. But as soon as we breach into the what I call the cylinder of sight, you will start seeing absorption. But let us assume that the actual absorption here, let's say Lyman alpha in this case, is optical depth of 100. So it's absolutely totally opaque. What are we going to see? When you get to this point M, this is the crucial thing in this cartoon, we are only covering, with this velocity, we're only covering that part of the cylinder. So the covering fraction is going to be this little line here divided by the full radius of the cylinder, so we're going to get this depth of the trough, okay? And as we'll go further, we'll cover a lot of the trough. We don't have to cover all of it because there's another dimension involved. But in any case, we're going to get a shape of the trough that will be like this. And then as the outflow coming out of the line of sight, we will get the covering fraction smaller and smaller. And since the battery here is dying, we'll shift to a conventional effort. So basically, we're going to get the shape of the covering fraction will be exactly like this in this cartoon. I manufactured to you a trough which is nothing but covering fraction dependent upon velocity. And of course, as I showed you, the data supports that totally. I see you shaking your head. Sure, it's crucial. Let me do that again. One ingredient that I did not mention is the absorption is this resonance line, so it's actually a delta function. In order to get any kind of a trough, you need to have gas accelerating, in your line of sight because you have to cover a delta frequency that is much larger than the intrinsic width of the line. So what I show here is, again, as the outflow accelerates, you'll have a low velocity here. You're not going to see any absorption because this does not come through your line of sight. When you get to this position, the absorption start getting into the line of sight. You'll start seeing absorption here. At this point, basically what you're going to get is, I assume that the material is very, very optically thick. But at this velocity, you see, this is where I'm covering things. In this velocity, I only cover this part of the source. This part of the source is not covered by the material with the same velocity. Therefore, I'm only going to get, in this case, about a third of the source covered. Well, when I'm here, in this simple picture, I'm going to cover all of the source, but again, it doesn't have to be fully black because we have another dimension to work with. And as I start going out, I start covering less and less and less, until here I will cover very little, and I will be in this part of the trough. Is better? Thanks. Okay. Now, how do we relate that to actual picture of accretion disk and stuff? This is what we do. We say that we have the continuum source here. We have the accretion disk. We'll have these, what I call, flow tubes coming out of it. And every time our line of sight cross one of these tubes, we're going to have a trough, which will be totally velocity-dependent covering factor. And we'll have, in this case, little knowledge about the absorption of the optical depth, if the optical depth is very high. If it's not very high, if it's between 0.5 and 3, we'll get the optical depth from the solution, because that's about our dynamical range. But if it's 10 or 50, you will still see a trough like that, and you won't have any knowledge about the optical depth. Well, this picture is a little bit more plausible than just this cartoon fashion, because my colleague Daniel Proga, when he does his disk wins, finds that even if you start, at least with some initial conditions, if you start with a wind that is, you know, homogeneous on the disk, many times radiation acceleration, which we use to accelerate these winds in the models, is unstable to the fact that you're going to get flow lines bunching up here and here, and you have very rarefied gas here. So in fact, you're going to have very similar picture to that. Basically, you're going to have a bunching up of material, and in effect, you're going to have these kind of troughs. Thanks. Now, this picture solves lots of phenomenological issues. 2 days ago, Roger was asking, what about the Ray Wyman result that these things do not accelerate? Well, in this really simplistic model, there's no problem because this is a standing pattern. As long as you assume that the outflow is stable, these troughs will stay here forever because the material will get here with the same velocity all the time, but next year it won't be the same material. It'll just go through, out of our line of sight, but there'll be a different material here with the same velocity. Of course, at the end of the day, there'll be instabilities and other things that will start changing stuff here, but to the first order approximation, it is much less troublesome that things do not accelerate, you know, in several years between observations. The other thing that can explain is the fact that lots of these troughs are detached, meaning that we're seeing a trough starting at 5,000 kilometers a second. How on hell does that work? Well, this gives it a very easy explanation. So, what I'm advocating is a paradigm shift in our view of these outflows. The first part is that we cannot trust all the good old techniques to measure absorption lines. Apparent optical depth, equivalent width, or Gaussian modeling are just useless when you're doing this kind of stuff in the UV on the optical, and because of the effects that I've shown you here. The reason for that is deeply physical. Our conceptual picture of the absorption medium have to change. We're not dealing with Gaussian clouds, we're dealing with outflows, and their line formation mechanism will be very different than what we're used to. And of course, operationally, we'll have to go and re-examine all the results for the NH and U in these things. Let me switch gear for a second and tell you what our colleagues in the X-rays are doing. As you know, most of you know, there was, over the last year, there was a big war, the warm absorber war, and the same object, whether or not it is showing a warm absorber, I think after the result that we were shown at the Munich conference in December, it seems like most of the field is agreeing that MCG minus 630 cannot be modeled well with the warm absorber. This is the work that Masao Sako here in the audience have done. You can see the best fit model with warm absorber, and you can see that it really can't fit all these features in the spectrum. And there's really no way to get it much better than that. And the fit that you do get with the relativistic lines is far, far better. But you can just see how we are in this total initial phase of all these studies in X-rays, because even in the, you know, prototypical object, people are still heatedly debating what's really happening. Now, the last thing I want to show in the X-rays is, where are we heading to? This is the million second exposure that Ian George group got on NGC 3783. The quality of the data you see in part of the spectrum here is really nice. Although the spectral resolution is only 500, because X-rays have very few photons, unfortunately, you still can do tremendous amount of stuff here when you have this signal to noise, and you can see where this field is heading to. If we want to know what's happening with the warm absorber in these objects, we have to put a huge investment of time. These programs that have 50 kiloseconds to 100 kiloseconds with Chandra or XMM, you just see too much noise, you can't really measure the lines, you can't do much. So the way to do these things is really to concentrate a lot of effort on several of these guys. Saying that, I go we'll go briefly about the observational ramification of what I showed you. In the old days, people thought that if you see carbon, nitrogen 5, carbon 4, and Lyman alpha, you can solve for everything. Well, it's just not the case. Lyman alpha, we don't have any hope on its own. I showed you, you just will never be able to tell the column density. Nitrogen 5 and carbon 4, the situation is better because they are doublets. If we have the objects with the right kind of the thing, I'll take a minute and a half. Okay. And if you have the right object, you can do that very well. Fuse, the UV satellite, helps us a lot. What we do see here is a Lyman series, which is priceless, because that, including the Lyman alpha that you see in HST, can really give you a handle of the neutral hydrogen. We can also see lines from carbon 3 and nitrogen 3. Ironically, most of the effort to this day was put on oxygen 6, but it is saturated in each and every object. So we really cannot see much from the oxygen 6. Now, China and XMM, we don't have the signal to noise to do anything I showed you before, but we have line series. So there, ironically, we can use equivalent width, because the game is very simple. Take the line series to the point where you stop being saturated until the equivalent width start obeying the oscillator strength ratio, and you know the column density. So what I have is... What? Sure. Give me one more minute. One more transparency before I'm summarizing, and that's it. Okay. What I show you here is something very simple. This is a different kind of a phase diagram which shows what we are doing in observation right now. Here is a observation with low, medium, or high signal to noise. Here is simultaneous covering by different spacecrafts. Most of the work done up until now is in this corner. We have lots of groups that get small amount of time on Chandra or Fuse or HST and try to get the physics. As I showed you, this can never ever give us the physical condition in the outflow. What we really need is to hit the main targets with huge amount of observational effort in order to get the connection. And huge amount is set up here. And I will put my conclusion before Julian will beat me up. And my conclusions will be following. You can read them here, and I will finish with that. Sure. Thank you.
On that diagram, yeah, that's the one.
If I put it correctly, of course.
It seems like before you really make any statements about the long absorber, you think that that's beautiful. Are there you've got to show independently that the covering fraction of the curve as a function of velocity for, say, 9.5 is the same covering fraction as, say, what you derive from the line series, for example. You need all of those things through. So the thing that I worry about this, you're going, geez, look at where you fit now. But you didn't make any corrections for the 9.5, which is offset actually. So that red curve, when you took another example, is probably going to go up like about the same amount or more than the black curve, and you still
It's an excellent point, but that's only because the shortness of my presentation. And the reason is, the following. You see, we do know that nitrogen 5 is not saturated. And the reason is, we have that thing, and it was actually hidden in one of my transparency, but I did not go over that. Here is the transparency, I'm making a whole mess of these things. See, what I didn't tell you is that the way I model nitrogen 5 is I model it with the correct optical depth ratio of 1 to 2. And you can see that if these guys fit well, these guys fit quite well also. There will be only a very small correction here, and I can really account for it. Because I already put the 1 to 2 ratio here as it is. So I know for a fact that in this case, nitrogen 5 is very close to optically thin, and I can get the accurate column density. If I'll have a slightly better data, you know, higher resolution, I can do the full solution of the covering fraction and everything, but I can't get the optical depth here.
If I could interject a comment of my own here, but the thought that sprang in my mind is that you need to do the same thing for the high resolution X-ray spectroscopy, because no doubt, as soon as you take a close look there, you'll see many of these same effects.
I'm absolutely sure, and my prediction is that, you know, over the next 10 years, since Chandra and XMM cannot not give us this, people will still use a lot of these cursed Gaussians every time they can. And in 10 years, or let's say 15 years down the line, we'll have Zeus, and then people say, ah, yes, now we have photons. Now we can see the covering fraction. Yes. I will expand on that a little bit. You're totally right. What's happening is the model that the XMM team is showing definitely has these high ionization lines. The issue in the modeling here is a very important distinction. Up until Chandra days, warm absorbers were defined as oxygen 6 or oxygen 7 edges with substantial optical depth. Okay? That is at least... Okay.
Back in the Ginga days, warm absorbers were iron, defined as iron features at 6 or 7 KeV.
Well, I stand corrected then. If that is the thing, what I do know is that the optical depth in the oxygen edges in MCG are insignificant in the XMM solution. So basically, what you see there is mainly the appearance of the lines, and that's fine. Everyone saw the lines before. The main, as far as I was concerned, as an outsider, the argument was always about the oxygen edges. If that wasn't the argument, then your point is totally valid. But I thought that was the main argument.
Arbitrarily large optical depth. And so when you draw those curves of optical depth, many of them will really be lower bound.
Yes, this is totally correct. On the work that we have done in PGO946, when we have a lot of HST data, almost all our limits were just lower limits because we could not say much more. But this is where lower limits are extremely useful because they can at least constrain the parameter space. As Julian said, if it's a lower limit, then we are allowing anything above the line. If it's an upper limit, we are allowing anything below the line. That can still give us a lot of physics if we are careful about what we are doing. So we don't really have to have the column density measurements. We can work a lot with these things. Yeah.
I guess this issue of the variability or lack of it of the line profiles, I think it's not just a question of saying that the flows are stationary. They also have to be axisymmetric because presumably this emanates from a disk.
Yeah.
And the disk is rotating underneath the absorbing region. And you know, if we take the view the absorption happens quite close, close in, then that's a fairly strong conclusion, it seems to me. And I'm just wondering if there are any ways of perhaps looking at the warm absorbers or elsewhere to also test the conclusion that it is a very strong, accurately axisymmetric outflow.
Yeah, I totally agree. This definitely will be a constraint on the model. I don't see right now an easy way to test it, but I do see something that strengthening my belief in that, and that is in many objects, as a time-dependent phenomena, we see new troughs building in front of our eyes. So basically, you start from a velocity that no absorption was there, and then velocity start building in. And again, it's easier to see such a thing if you break a little bit of the axisymmetry. If you, let's say, you have the wind over, you know, 2 pi, you know, only over 1 pi of the circumference, then as this gets to the line of sight, you will start seeing the absorption, and that velocity will increase in depth. So this is very speculative, but at least it's consistent with this kind of a model. So in many cases, it doesn't have to be totally symmetric, but it has to be along a significant extent of the angle of the disk.
Thank you.